This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutin, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Amar Fuad Rahmat, the show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and concepts the better to understand how society works. Each week, we will discuss a classic text or an idea that we hope will shed light on the world around you. And today, the idea is dialectics, but Marxist dialectics in particular. Fuad, take it away.
Well, we've actually used this word a lot in our previous episodes, but rarely did we, I don't think we ever did at any point explain it. So I figured, well, why not? It's reaching a year soon, so we might as well.
So this kind of self-reflexive moment. We're kind of looking back on ourselves and trying to like
fill in the blanks. Yeah.
Okay. Very
and,
good.
Yeah, we use this a lot actually in the show to reference a bunch of things. So I thought, well, today let's put some content into that.
Okay. So where do you start when you talk about dialectics? Is it a concept that emerges in the modern period, or is it something that's kind of ancient and part of classical philosophy and
theory? It's actually a part of classical philosophy. It has a long history, and even Eastern philosophy has its own dialectics. And really, the term is broadly, if we want to look at the different trends in the history of philosophy, really means truth by engagement and interaction and dialogue. So that's sort of what it means broadly. But at the turn of the modern period, it took on a different meaning. And by the time it got to Marx, it was a different conceptual framework altogether.
So that's, the mid-19th century?
Correct. And essentially what dialectics is about is a method of understanding totality. And by totality, I mean everything. And now, the common skeptical, and I think rightly skeptical reaction to that is, well, what does everything mean, right? Because that's a lot of philosophers claim to want to offer us knowledge of everything. You know, Al-Ghazali, for example, like the mystical philosopher we discussed before, everybody's offered this. But the interesting thing about the Marxist dialectics is that I think we can understand it as offering us a view of the totality of, in terms of a worldview, in terms of a life experience.
Okay, so something that's still very earthbound, terra firma, under our feet, mm-hmm. not necessarily an understanding of, say, the universe or its genesis, right?
Yes. So, okay. Yes. And this everythingness is very much tied to life and existence. And in particular, for Marx's case, life in a capitalist society. So he was of the view that the totality of the world, including its history, can be explained dialectically through a study of how capitalism formed and certain contradictions that takes place. So once you get that, you get the picture of everything, of that totality that he wants to point us to.
So is that a totality, you know, the kind of synchronic moment? I mean, the totality of the now? Or is it the totality that is historical, the diachronic, the distinction that was made for us in one of the previous shows, right?
With Saussure.
Yeah. So because, you know, capitalism is a historically contingent mm-hmm. and locatable phase of mm-hmm. economic life, can you then project back into time, as it were?
Because it's dialectical, you can, because it promises everything, right? But only within certain bounds and the bounds of contemporary experience, in that you can look at contemporary times as very much defined as capitalists. And it's from that perspective you can look at history. You know, it's from that perspective you can look at how we came to be as a capitalist society. So again, it's totality insofar as it's rooted, like you said, to the earthly experience, to something that is on the ground, that's concrete, that's material. And that he calls it, it's also called the materialist dialectic for this reason. And it is from that vantage point that you can look at history and see how we've come to this point. But it's not history of everything, of every possible experience in the past. It's not like that. But again, it comes back to the capitalist present.
Okay, can I ask a very kind of seemingly silly question? Does Marxist dialectics begin with Marx?
No, actually. If you want to trace it back, you can see that it's really rooted to Hegel's dialectic, which is, you know, it's a whole other set of discussion. I mean, I've, you know, my dream, one of my dreams, Sharad, is to be able to do more Hegel for night school, but he's so complicated, he's so easily reduced that, you know, as a fan of Hegel, I always worry that I might not do justice to him. You know, he's always often misunderstood. That aside, you know, I think for the purposes of introducing Marx's dialectic, we can say, and this actually ties into the second aspect of dialectic, that Marx got the notion of change through contradiction from Hegel. And what Hegel was trying to do was respond to Kant's formulation of the antinomies. So just backtracking a bit, Kant had this thing called antinomies, which showed the limits of pure reason. You know, so reason, at some point, if you utilize it enough as an instrument, you'll reach these contradictions. On one hand, reason will always posit the final cause of something. But at the same time, using reason, that final cause can always be challenged and questioned, right? So the human mind is trapped between these two polars, between, on one hand, this desire to arrive to one final reason to explain a chain of causes. But on the other hand, a kind of infinite regression, because you can always question it, right? So, and what Kant had to do was to posit a distinction between the phenomena and the noumena, the world that is intelligible and the world that is beyond our intelligibility. And for what Hegel did was to show that these contradictions were part of a whole, of a kind of unified total experience of consciousness, that you don't see them as separate entities going in separate directions, but they are in actuality part of a larger whole of the human mind. So, but what this is where Marx differs, because for Marx, the contradiction isn't mental, isn't just a feature of consciousness, it's actually happening in the world. And what Marx's dialectics points to is that these contradictions are, like I said, not only just concrete happening in the world, but they are actually what's moving society. As we all know, the key contradiction that Marx focused on was between the contradiction between workers and capital. So rather than this being some phenomena of the mind, the contradictions are happening on the ground. In fact, not just on the ground, it's happening to us. We're a part of it. We're a part of it in that we're embedded in this life world, this experience of these contradictions. And it colors our life in that way, yeah.
So, okay, I want to just come back to that formulation, the capitalists and workers. As I understand it, the contradiction turns on the private nature of ownership, but the social against the social nature of the creation of value. So workers are involved in creating value. They're brought together by capitalists and all these other elements to make things. But in some ways, that social character is somehow negated by the stealing away, the expropriation of value. Having discovered this, he then reads it back in history. Can he go back to, say, the land of the pharaohs and their system and say, hey, okay, we have that too in existence?
He goes back to primitive communism, whereby there's no notion of private property, right? And he shows that, he looks at, there's a chapter in The Capital called The Secret of Primitive Accumulation. And it's basically an account of how capitalism came to be, you know, where there was this huge dramatic seizure of other people's property and became bloody, so on and so forth. And the workers lost their means of production. But I think the key thing what we can extract for our discussion here is that it is this tension in history between those who have capital and those who have to sell their labor, like you said, that animates society.
So you have the contradiction, but it's also moving in time. So you have this structure that works against each other, private ownership against the social character of labor. But it's also continually evolving, and those tensions push society forward to new forms. So you can actually go from having no property to having property owned by a pharaoh, king, demigod, to then moving into
a CEO today.
Yeah, yeah. To, you know, maybe a merchant class in between them. Yeah, but yeah, yeah, okay.
But yeah, and, fast forward it. Yeah.
And some CEOs that believe that behave like pharaoh, kings, demigods.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So so that's the dialectics aims to. It gives us a lot of these concepts by which we can look at history, certain experiences that nonetheless endure despite the changes. So pharaoh, merchant class, CEO, in many ways analogous despite their different manifestations in history. And I do want to add a footnote to what you said about evolution, right? Society does evolve, but I think that the main thing, that's a classical picture of, you know, Marx's take on the trajectory of history, in that at some point capitalism will just implode and the workers will seize power and redesign society. I mean, that's sort of his view. But we
and
don't
then,
have to, yeah.
And then the contradiction ends and history ends too.
Yes. But a certain kind of history. But I think just for the purposes of listening to BFM, what we can perhaps take away from it is just to see and to reflect on, meditate on how a lot of the issues, the way society changes, how we understand our, even the paths of our lives, our career paths, a lot of it depends on material conditions, in that ultimately these are the things that change the world, you know. And once we understand this, we have a more interesting and complete picture of what the world is about, you know.
Now, so Hegel had an analysis that produced an idealist dynamic or an idealist view of the world, and it had a dialectic. So is it a process where Marx takes this idea and applies it to certain facts about the world that he sees around him or described by him or others, and says, well, I actually see in it, you know, these same sort of structures. I mean, how does one do dialectical materialism?
How does one do dialectical materialism? Okay, well, there are two questions there. One is how Marx found his formula in Hegel. For Hegel, history is about the onward coming to consciousness of this thing he calls Geist, or spirit. And spirit is this thing that's always easily misunderstood. And what essentially I would summarize it as is consciousness of life. And this is tied to the larger concern that Hegel had in overcoming atomism or solipsism, the idea that only you exist in the world, that everything else is secondary or not really as real as you, right? So he wants to show that consciousness of life is actually a consciousness of others and consciousness of existence in a culture, of a kind of spirit of the time, so on and so forth. But for Marx, he felt that this wasn't critical enough. The question Marx posed was, well, what sustains this consciousness of life? And this made him look at labor, you know, which is actually something that Hegel theorized as well. The alienation of labor was also found in Hegel. But what Marx saw was that there was a redemptive element to labor. For Hegel, labor is always alienation, and you redeem yourself through consumption. So Hegel had this sort of bourgeois notion of self-constitution, whereas for Marx, he associated labor as poesis, as of creating the world, and he saw this as fundamentally more hopeful than the picture of history that Hegel had. So from there, you can tell the similarities and the difference, in that they both do see that ultimately history aspires to a kind of a recognition of freedom as a key principle. But for Hegel, this freedom was couched in terms of Geist, which is consciousness of life, which Marx thought was very mystical. And for Marx, the freedom should be expressed in terms of labor. That's sort of the higher, more radical expression of freedom. So that's how Marx drew his method from Hegel.
So, okay, so you've laid the groundwork, as it were, for an understanding of what Marx does then with the dialectical method. And in the next section, we'll do more on how to. And the how to, you know, it's like tool time. How do you do dialectical materialism? Kids, don't try it at home. Just listen to us. Okay, that's Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. I'm Sharad Kutin. And you're listening to Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, and I'm Sharad Kutan, and you're listening to Night School with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, who is trying to get across a very complex idea. It's Marx's dialectics. So in the first part, we looked at how Marx really took on the ideas of Hegel and turned it on its head. But it still seems rather abstract to me, Fuad. I mean, how exactly do you use dialectical materialism?
Okay, this is a great question, right? So we've talked about sort of the historical background, the theoretical foundations, and let's get back to its practicality, in which, you know, I know BFM is all about practicality. Okay, the first thing is that as a dialectician, what you need to look for are connections. Nothing stands alone by itself. We're always a part of social relations. So I know there's this bourgeois tendency to think that, you know, our individuality is so unique that ultimately our authenticity is defined against society, community and culture, so on and so forth. But what dialectics would show, because it's concerned with totality, is how we are embedded in prior social relations that are larger than us. And Marx takes this further by showing that a significant aspect of how we are constituted has a lot to do with our economic position or class, you know. So let's take an easy example, a criminal. You know, the analytic view, the atomized view, would look at the criminal simply as a bad person, simply as somebody who hasn't gotten enough moral education, so on and so forth. But what the dialectical view would look at is his social position as an embedded individual in society, right? It will look at questions of crime in general, not just this individual. It will look at why criminals end up committing crimes, what are the options that are often before criminals when they commit the crimes, what are the social and systemic causes of crime, so on and so forth.
What even is it, also is sometimes the changing nature or definition of crime.
Correct.
Crime itself is never kind of fixed, right?
Exactly. And why this view is enabled is because, again, like we mentioned in the first part of the show, dialectics functions on two premises. The first is that we are always connected to something larger than us, a set of social relations, and that these set of social relations are constituting us as we go about our lives, in that we're not just this atomized, isolated entities that go about existing without any social markers or imprints.
What's interesting is that in many ways, the tendency to think about social life in terms of, as you put it, atomized entities, the individual, it really comes out of that society, that a society encourages you to think. The way we live, the way we experience life really does make us think that that is the basis for action and that's the basis for mm-hmm. ethics and stuff like that, the individual. Mm-hmm. And assume that Marx also existed in the same world. Why is it that Marx would step out of that framework and seek to see social life in terms of classes, in terms of larger social groupings, in terms of these kinds of relationships? Do we have any sense of what makes it possible for one to think differently about very similar, the same phenomenon? Basically, we're looking out and seeing very different views. You have a bourgeois lens, which bourgeois, by the way, means bad, and you know,
especially in this series. Yeah.
Or you have a Marxist lens, which lends a kind of dialectical tint to the world. I mean, what allows for these two different visions?
This goes back to Hegel too. For Hegel, there's always an underlying structure to society. There's always, you know, society is always changing, and that our access to this change is largely partial. You know, it begins partial before you employ its philosophical method to see the larger whole. But in seeing the larger whole, you will see that there are many, many aspects of society or the world that the dominant framework doesn't address. And this is largely to do with ideology, because it is the classes, for Marx especially, the classes that dominate a society that creates the discourse by which society abides. And in order to see the larger picture, which is what dialectics aims for, this picture of totality, one would have to look at what the discourse misses. And in the formation of Marx's world, where capitalism was running rampant, and there was just so much triumphant posturings about what capitalism can offer, the plight of the workers, the plight of the rabble, the plight of the poor are often obscured, despite the fact that there are poor people and oppressed workers enabling that society to begin with. So Marx took the route of providing a bigger picture in the spirit of the dialectical inquiry to see the extent to which those marginalized by society nonetheless play an important role in enabling it. So once you get that larger picture, you realize that society or the world cannot be defined only by a narrative that's churned out by a certain elite or a small segment of society. So like you said, a lot of the bourgeois kind of attitudes towards existence, which for the most part cherishes the individual, it really stems out from a privileged position that only the few who can really think of themselves as individual abstracted from society can really enjoy. So the dialectical method allows us to see that, you know, nothing can be explained without taking into account the way in which larger society works. And for Marx, that is capitalism. Yeah.
Now, if you took the methodology, if you kind of took on the principles that you suggested or listed out just now, does it necessarily make you a Marxist in terms of your reading or analysis of society? Because you can think in terms of larger social groups, one that goes beyond the individual without necessarily landing squarely on Marxist ground.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And this is the second aspect of dialectical thinking that we can apply, and that is to look at our economic position as central to how we are constituted. And one way to look at this is not economics in the abstract sense of business jargon or abstract theories, but to look at essentially your relationship to your material condition, the extent to which you can secure your livelihood. And it is out of that phenomena, Marx believes, that we can tell a great deal about how society works. So for example, right, there's a lot of vilification about rampates. We all know this is all over TV3 all the time. This is how
this is motorcycle bikers, young people.
Yeah, young, largely urban Malay, underclass bikers who essentially hog highways, usually after 11 p.m. till the early
race morning. About, sometimes commit crime, sometimes.
Yes, they're often associated with criminal activity, so much so they become a subculture. There are movies made about rampates now. Mm. And the common analysis of it, even though this is not what's most visible, but the way people talk about it is as a moral issue, you know? Mm. So it's like, what's wrong with these rampates? They'll say, oh, tak cukup agama, or you know, not enough religious training, or tak cukup kasih ibu bapa, or something. It's not enough. It's bad parenting, so on and so forth. You know, but if you look at it from a dialectical standpoint, you can see that it's a form of rebelling against the harshness of living in a precarious relationship with your material conditions. Rampates are often the young underclass who are cut off from the larger middle class with their aspirations, who are not represented in the mainstream discourse of what constitutes Malayness, what constitutes wholesome Malaysian adolescence, so on and so forth. And a subculture develops as a way of reclaiming themselves against that larger narrative, right? But that is only possible because the different relationship between the middle classes and the underclass out of which rampates come, the different relationship they have to material conditions.
What's very interesting, of course, is that I guess for young people and that class of young people are the pressures of discipline, right? Industrial discipline that are being slowly but surely imposed upon them, that they will need to become members of the industrial workforce and they have to learn certain practices of the body, you know, getting up in the morning, being on time, punctuality, all these things in order to serve the greater machine that they become part of, right? And there must be all these tensions between that, you know, the reconfiguring of your body for the purposes of somebody else's, for somebody else to make a profit, and your own inner desires to explore the limits of your body, to explore other bodies, and, you know, social, and of course the commingling of the sexes is a huge problem, and a huge sort of anxiety for not just the governments, but also communities, right? They're constantly, so there are a lot of pressures that come on to the individuals and these groups of young people. So,
and I think what you describe is a good way of demonstrating what would be revealed if we look at a certain social phenomena dialectically through a materialist lens, in that you do not see them as just lost and morally corrupt individuals. You see them as, like you said, you know, concrete products of a certain regime of labor that's produced out of this capitalist machine. You know, just to add another anecdote, I did a little report on the minimum wage for the B-side, which is, as you know, BFM's tablet magazine, and I got to interview this this factory worker, this woman who's been in this factory in Banting for 23 years, you know, and she works 12-hour shifts, you know, 7 in the morning to 7 in the evening. And by the time she gets home, she's exhausted. You know, 80% of her time at work is standing up because she has to tend to machines. So by the time she gets home, she gets a bad back. She's too exhausted to really spend time with the kids, you know. And she falls asleep early to get up early. And it takes an hour to commute to the factory. And essentially what this means is that she has very little time for her children. You know, and this is a very common occurrence for low-wage workers in Malaysia, who also have to compete to keep their already crappy wages with foreign workers who are coming here by the droves, right? So they have little time family, they have to work during holidays. And she told me, well, this is, you know, of course our kids are going to end up rempits and bosias. We just have very little time for them, right? So this is the big picture. This is the totality of existence for this, you know, a significant population of our country.
Right. So, but her view of her situation isn't dialectical, right? I mean, there she sees it as her fate, or she sees it as her situation, and then her failures to fulfill her parental duties. But does she then go on to kind of make the connection and see it as the fate of not just herself, but this whole class of people, and then locate the problem somewhere elsewhere?
I was very, very inspired to in that conversation, because I saw that they do see themselves as they do see their class position, but only partially, because there is still a lot of coldness between the local workers and the migrant workers and so forth. So it's not the kind of fully coming to consciousness that Marx would have, you know, predicted, but there is that. And this is something about Marx too, in that it is through your material position that you start seeing the contradiction in society. And workers are, for Marx, in the best position to see it, because they are the ones generating the kind of the engine that is a capitalist society.
I mean, what it reminds me of is the work by Ong Ai Wah, you know, who's a Malaysian sociologist, I think, based in the US now. Mm-hmm. And she wrote a book about the phenomena of spirit possession among young Malay factory workers, and who lived in hostels often, you know. And in there you have a rather interesting, again, issue, a relationship of the body of the worker, you know, and this time gendered, because she's, you know, as a woman, there are all kinds of plays. On one hand, you have the demands of discipline within the factory, you know, again, timekeeping and to the extent that you know, factory regimes, it'll be shocking for middle-class Malaysians to know that what factory workers are subjected to, you know, how long your toilet breaks can be, mm-hmm. you know, attempts to stop people from skiving or malingering or whatever it is, you know, and all this creates these regimes of control for the body of the worker. On the other hand, the demands of a consumer society that wants the woman to, you know, to beautify herself, to buy cosmetic products, so she's...
Hence the contradiction, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah. So you have, and so there you have, you know, the discipline maybe cast in religious terms, and then the other pull, which is to open yourself up to this world and, you know, and really become a full consumer within modern industrial society. So, and that how that comes out in these forms. And one of the forms available to express the frustration or anger or tension is in the...
mass hysteria.
The mass hysteria. Yeah. So the mass hysteria. So what she doesn't do, of course, as an anthropologist, is to take the mass hysteria at face value. I mean, I think there is a level which she does take the mass hysteria seriously, but she looks beyond it and she kind of ferrets out these really interesting conditions that make this not just a situation for a BOMO to settle, but really for a sociologist and anthropologist to think deeply about the nature of industrial society.
Mm-hmm. And I think at this juncture, I want to highlight another key thing that you would have to look for using the material dialectics. It would be to look for contradictions. And contradictions are in our lives too. In the sense, you know, the simple, I think, example everybody can relate to is the contradiction of our notions of freedom. In the sense that we are told, or society inculcates, modern capitalist society inculcates this idea that we are free as individuals to choose and so forth. But we have very little freedom when it comes to the workplace. At the workplace, you know, it's the least democratic space there is in any modern society, right? In fact, it's very coercive in many ways, which is why I freelance. But fundamentally...
I don't know what you're saying, because BFM is just paradise on earth.
But fundamentally, that's the contradiction. Think of how much of your life is spent in an office, at a workplace, you know, where you have really little say or any democratic values in there, other than the usual token family day or something. But, I mean, I'm just trying to show that these are the contradictions that are always happening every day in our lives. And it is in this circumstance that so much of our personality is shaped.
Now, okay, so if you were involved in Marxist dialectics, do you necessarily come to the kind of political positions that we associate with Marxism?
Yeah, I think there was a point when those two were almost inseparable, in that the dialectical method would point the road to revolution. And I'm talking about the early 20th century when labor unions are very strong. I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think if, you know, workers realize their power and the fictive nature of capital, things can change. And a part of me is still open to the idea that it might happen one day. It might not be in our lifetime, might not be in 4 or 5 centuries, but I think it can happen. But that said, you can be a good dialectician, you know, like you said, in a purely academic setting, or just purely from out of everyday experience to better understand society through that as a method, without really subscribing to the historical eschatology, if you will, you know.
Ooh, eschatology. Now he's talking about the end of the world and
capitalist world,
the coming of the Messiah. Okay, but okay, how does one, last question for us, how does one become a good dialectician?
I think always check the moment whenever you isolate anything. When you think that your angst is completely so unique and so, you know, so individual that nobody else can understand, or when you posit yourself against society, posit yourself against culture, you know, or posit one thing from another as if they're discrete. Those things are very undialectical. So always check yourself for that, and always look for connections where they might not be. Now, the key caveat I have is not dialectics doesn't call for everything to be collapsed to social experience. It's not reductive, you know, because everything means everything. Everything does not mean community, society, or culture. That's not everything. Everything means the totality of what makes capitalism the social phenomena it is. So it includes your inner monologue as much as includes your time out there in the labor market, you know. So see the connections, and when you do that, you're already starting your first step towards becoming a dialectician.
And is there a manual to help you get there?
Well, Marx never wrote any one particular comprehensive treatise on dialectics. It's largely peppered through his writings. I mean, the one good place to start is a very simple text. It's the 10 Theses of Feuerbach, where he charts the distinction between idealism and Feuerbach's materialism, which is also interesting, and what he does with it. You know, I mean, just to show that, you know, our ideas are embedded in social relations. So even something as intimate as the images in our head are rooted to social life. And it's really a very, I mean, it's like, I don't know, what, a few sentences, you know, and 10 theses on Feuerbach. Yeah, 10 theses, very short, and you can read it in like 15 minutes and you get a sense of what he's after. If you really want to go to the roots of it, you know, Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit, you know, which is really, fun read. I see
did
my...
Did you say fun read?
Yeah, I think it is. You know, I actually enjoy reading Hegel, even though I don't buy him. You know, I think outlook-wise, I'm more partial to Marx. But in terms of just thinking about philosophy, I actually enjoy Hegel. So that's yeah, and there's so many guides there on YouTube on how to read it and, you know, what to look for and stuff like that. So
okay, yeah. So there you are. If you want more information from Fuad about how to read and how to develop yourself as a dialectician, there's always Facebook, and you, please you know give us your comments. It's coming to the end of the year, and you know, we really could use some fresh thinking about how to deliver our discussions better. And so please do send us your interventions on Facebook. Also, there's a Gmail account. That's bfmnightschool@gmail.com. And you can tweet me at Sharad Kutin. You can't tweet Fuad, not yet.
Email us, though. Yeah,
yeah, maybe never. So thank you so much, Fuad, for that. You've been listening to Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, myself, Sharad Kutin. This is Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.